This is the Liminalist, the podcast between. It's Jason Horsley talking to Simon Strong.
Yeah, the street man. It makes me feel like I'm waking up.
Hello. I'm just trying to identify that picture behind you. It looks like a cross between Karl Marx and a cat.
Yeah, Karl Marx, that's what most people say. It's a German painter. I don't even really know his name. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I don't know. Karl Marx.
It resembles, or it actually is meant to be Karl Marx?
No, it's a self-portrait. The guy himself painted himself.
I see.
So it's a coincidence.
It is a coincidence.
Strange coincidence. I used to have Karl Marx, well, not pictures, but I certainly used to identify with philosophy.
Oh. Well, that's a whole subject unto itself. Perhaps not the best place to start, seeing as I know almost nothing about Karl Marx. Except that an awful lot of people dislike the guy currently.
Yeah.
Perhaps as many people like him, I don't know. So.
Yeah. We have a starting point. I looked at the email I wrote you and the response. There's a lot in there, I guess.
Yeah, I didn't actually go back to it as prep. I just remembered that your interest in clinical psychology, that seemed like that was going to be a big enough subject. But if this does turn out to be a podcast, we should probably just sum up how we came to do this. So you found me via Branko Malik, I think, and then you've been listening, and then you just sent me an email and seemed like we had enough shared interest to want to hook up.
Yeah, so what I found most interesting, was, for one thing, you seem to be very interested into psychology and also depth psychology, Jung. That was what your whole, the one podcast with Branko, there was a main part about this. And, well, this is interesting for me as a psychologist, although I have to say I'm not really well versed in Jung, because it's in academic circles, at least in Germany, he's out. Like analytical and depth psychology, that's out. It's all this cognitive behavioral, basically the behaviorism, mm-hmm. I would say. So Jung is not on Vogue anymore. And what I also noticed, I don't really know when I first listened to your podcast. I've been doing it for a while regularly, but today I also started the last one you made, with I forgot the name, but you're talking about. Exactly, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I noticed you've been moving towards some kind of, you've been approaching Orthodox religion and Christianity, and that's what happened to me. That's the way I'm on as well.
Hmm.
And by the way, I got there was starting in occultism, I guess, and that's something you've experienced, I believe.
Did you say you got a start in occultism?
That's where I, when I was studying, that's the thing, when you study psychology, you're a reductionist, basically. I mean, you have the reductionist mindset. It's all, it's all evolution. There's no soul, certainly no God, certainly no metaphysics or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. So no psyche either then, really.
No.
Took the psyche out of psychology.
Totally, yeah. I mean, they call it neuroscience and all that.
So Freud would be considered occultism practically at this point.
In a way. He would, yeah.
It's ironic.
I started, I don't know, do you know this guy Krishnamurti?
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's two, right? But the gentleman. Jiddu Krishnamurti. That's why I first started them, and I don't know, endless readings I've done, but I read some Crowley as well. That's as dangerous as I got, I guess.
That's about as dangerous as it gets, I would say, with Crowley, in terms of reading, anyway.
Reading. I did some practices, like these imagination things, but they were too hard. I didn't really follow them through.
So this predated your becoming a clinical psychologist, or it was parallel?
Parallel, yeah.
So that's interesting that you were pursuing two parallel paths that, I guess, like parallel lines, they don't meet.
Yeah. I don't know. I think every person has this, I mean, this thirst for the transcendence. I would say that's a given, but I guess people can, you can distract yourself from it, or you can maybe, to use a Freudian term, sublimate it. Like, I don't know, going to occultism. I mean, that's, at least it promises transcendence.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it can deliver. Certainly, maybe it can deliver, but maybe not the right kind or the right direction of transcendence. Like if you take a vertical axis, you probably end up going down, I guess, in many cases.
Or horizontally, I think. I mean, this is this vertical, idea of going downward was the thing that came up with Branko, and he felt that Jung's thing was downward going. And I, you know, my first response, well, isn't it both? Like the way I understood and have applied Jungian psychology, to the extent that I have this metaphorical notion that Jordan Peterson likes to roll out now and then about the roots that go to hell in order that the branches can reach heaven. The way I applied that was in terms of having to do the inner work, do the inner excavation to find out, to get to the source of one's patterns and one's neuroses in order to heal them, and that allows for integration and wholeness, which allows for an ascent, right? So I still think I still more or less ascribe to that, even if it's not in Jungian terms. I might put it in different terms. So I wonder if occultism, because occultism's about both going down and inward and up and outward. So in that sense, it's congruent with psychology, even though I would say it tends to, and probably this might be true of clinical psychology too, it tends to de-emphasize the element of surrender, of acquiescence to, I suppose, like it seems to all be about going inward in order to fix stuff or in order to transform stuff, whereas more and more I see it as simply letting oneself get pulled towards those wounds because they have a natural gravitational pull anyway. So just sort of letting go of the subterfuges that prevent us from getting sucked back into them, and then doing nothing, like not trying to confront them or transform them or anything, but simply letting them speak to us, perhaps. So that's the difference, as I see it, a subtle one between what I consider true or good positive psychology and occultism. But what I was going to say as a second point was that I wonder if the difference then isn't so much between going upward or downward, between occultism and religion, or true psychology, as in it's a vertical axis either way, but going horizontally, as in just wanting to explore one's own potential as an ego, or expand one's own potential as an ego, like expanding it outward into the infinite, in order to have a sort of endless array of potential experiences that can prevent actually that final integration, which is the loss of the ego.
So you mean living out these experiences as well, or more of in the realm of imagination?
Yeah, more the latter, more like generating new experiences, like creating new narratives. And it might not be to do with disciplines, actually. I mean, it could be. I mean, I'm open to the possibility that somebody could follow an occult path and still end up surrendering to reality. Why not? I mean, someone could get there through plumbing, I'm sure, probably more easily.
By surrendering, you mean surrendering to, ultimately surrendering to God, or?
I just use the term reality because, well, because it's less loaded, and like one can sort of apply that in an everyday way, like every moment, not every moment, but every day there are countless opportunities slash challenges I encounter where my reality seems untenable and unpleasant, and I'm fighting against it, and there's a part of me that's saying just surrender, and so I'm constantly sort of developing a capacity to do that, to just surrender to the difficult and unpleasant and humiliating nature of reality.
So that would involve an act of will, like to surrender, you would need to employ your will. You would need to kind of go upward, go against something, not follow the path of least resistance.
Yeah, that's right. It's that's certainly a tricky question, isn't it? Whether it requires will, because it seems like, does it require will to surrender one's will? It seems like that would be impossible. Like that would just be an endless sort of, push and pull, like trying to get a sticking plaster off your finger, and it just keeps going back and forth. So, I think it's something else is. This might be related, but we're watching, my wife and I are watching this TV show called In Treatment, which is an HBO show from 2008 with Gabriel Byrne. I don't know, did you hear about it?
No.
It's actually very good. It's based on, I think, a Jewish show, and they've basically translated it into English. I mean, they've redone it, but they've kept the script intact and everything from what I read. And it's clearly written by a therapist or a group of therapists, people who know the field, and they really stack the decks against Gabriel Byrne, the therapist, in that the clients he have are just constantly triggering him, and one's having sex with the other while he and he's falling in love with the one that's having sex with another client, and his wife's having an affair, and basically, so you're getting to see that dynamic of a therapist who is trying to hold a space in which it's safe for the person to have all their reactions, which requires the therapist not to react. Like that's what makes the safe space, partly, is the therapist isn't giving in to his or her own reactions. He might be getting triggered, but is using whatever this quality is to inhibit.
That's something that's something I do. I have to do in this job I'm currently doing. I'm not really sure if it helps, if it's of any help to, if it can be of any help. I mean, okay, I guess they would do more, right? This therapist, you would not just provide the safe space, but also giving advice.
Well, it's because it's a TV show, he's very proactive and he's doing a lot of talking and provoking, which is kind of how I have done it in my past when I've played the role of therapist to people, which I have. But certainly it's not generally the orthodox or the what's considered the correct method of psychotherapy, which is to be, I think, much more passive, to listen, to hold the space, and to guide the patient by asking questions, but not to be telling them what they're feeling or giving advice, which is what he's doing. I mean, I think holding the space is the whole thing, essentially, but the person holding space does have to be present as a individual, as a human, so they have to be speaking and responding, otherwise, it wouldn't feel safe. So then it's, this is why I brought it up. It's this weird middle area, liminal space, I suppose, between reacting and suppressing one's reaction. It's like you can't do either. It seems impossible, really. And that's what I understand by surrender, because it's easy enough to be passive and just suppress all of your negative. Well, it's not necessarily easy, but certainly one can do it, and it isn't beneficial to anyone. to be suppressing one's negative emotions, but nor is it to be indulging them. So there's this middle area, which is about, it's almost like that one creates or allows to form this buffer area in which the negative emotions come up and they enter into this enclosed space before they get expressed, and then so they get sort of quarantined, and then we as awareness can see them and then we express them. That's sort of how I experience it. And that's something I've observed in being married for many years, is I will be reacting, but I'll also be watching myself and sort of saying, well, I'm reacting now and I'm doing this on purpose, and it's partly bullshit, it's partly like I'm just justifying my anger, but it's partly true too. There is a part of me that's saying you need to express this now and you can't suppress it, so do it, but watch yourself while you're doing it.
I don't know, since I moved closer towards acceptance of traditional religion, well, let's say Christianity, basically.
Yeah.
I tend to think that there's some reactions maybe one just shouldn't give in to. Whereas earlier, when I was still dabbling in occultism or in general, I think how most people, how we live our lives in the hedonistic society, it's like you're entitled to have all these reactions, to live out your urges. And I have to say, from my experience, clinical psychology, it's not so much that they teach you, well, yeah, of course, if there's an alcoholic, of course, it's all about teaching the person how to somehow inhibit his urges and not give in to drink. But there's so much feel good talk, like you need to express yourself, you need to do this, do that, express yourself. But in the end, I always get the impression it's so much about giving into your urges, basically, justifying them and justifying why you have these urges, and understanding them and getting to know how you develop them, what were the childhood influences that shaped your psyche, maybe. They wouldn't say psyche, they would just say shaped your brain, wired your brain.
Right.
That's the psyche officially.
Yeah.
And now what I was going to say, since I started to read some theology, moral theology, and in general traditional religion, I get the idea that maybe the will is much more important than we usually consider it to be, like how we restrain ourselves from doing bad things and how we employ it against some resistance to do good, moral good. And that's just something that's also a part that I wanted to talk about, that because that's something you never hear in psychology, in therapy, clinical psychology, whatever. Like, the will is out. Basically, they're saying there is no such thing because it's all in the brain, and the brain is shaped by experience. And
it's predetermined.
It's total determinism, yeah.
So that it's about just changing the determination, like changing your neurology in order to change your predetermined path.
that's how they present it. I mean, it's in a way, it's not consistent, right? Because then what's the therapist doing? I mean, he's just following his wiring, and you get this whole clockwork where everything's determined. But of course you have free agents. But I really have to say, because I studied a lot, like I wanted to do it very well in school while I was studying, and I completely absorbed this, like having no free will. And it's only now that I'm waking up. I mean, of course, I didn't live my life as if I had no free will, because that's impossible, because I think we do. But it's just so much easier to justify your mistakes or some evil you do, even if you tell yourself, oh well, it's my wiring, it's my brain.
I suppose. I mean, I think it can go both ways, but I think you're right. I mean, there's a culture now that, I mean, more and more this culture has coalesced of permissiveness, that not just justifies but validates and celebrates even perversion, essentially. I mean, this is, I trace back this back to Havelock Ellis, who was the first sexologist and the founding Fabian, and he...
What's his name? Can you repeat it?
Havelock Ellis.
You know him?
Yeah, well, he's not particularly well known, and even in psychological fields, I suppose, because they've, you know, but all of this is, like, you can't separate Freud from clinical psychology just because they don't want to talk about Freud. Like, there wouldn't be such a thing. It's no. Evolved or mutated or degenerated into this, what it is now. And anyway, so Ellis is one of these key figures, and as in some ways as key as Freud, perhaps, possibly. But his main focus was sex, and one of the things he said or wrote, he was like an early Alfred Kinsey, like a forerunner of Alfred Kinsey. Was the same agenda, essentially, and he actually spelled it out in one book, which was that the true individual would be a sort of would be measured by the depths of his perversity. I'm paraphrasing, but essentially he equated perversity with individuality, as in the more truly individual we become, the more perverse our behavior. But he didn't mean it critically. He meant that this would be a confirmation that we had become true individuals, because our sexuality would express in more and more perverse ways, separating it, I presume, I haven't read the whole book, from A, the harmful effects of perverse behavior, and B, the true etiology of perversion, which I'd say is trauma.
One way or another. You'd say it's trauma?
Yes, I would. And this is, I mean, to bring it down to a concrete thing, something I discovered while I was working on my article about transgender.
Yeah,
You mentioned that in the email, didn't you?
Yeah, I read this.
Right. So while I was looking into homosexuality, I noticed this curious thing that it's permissible to attribute homosexuality to social factors only if they're benign.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
But you can't say that negative social factors caused homosexuality, which clearly makes no sense at all, except as an ideological argument, which is we have decided that homosexuality is good, therefore it's caused by good things, right? So that's just an example of this culture of permissiveness, which seems to... I'd say that psychology, along with everything else, has got shackled to it. Yeah.
Have you read this? You had an interview with Theodore Dalrymple. Have you read his book on psychology? Because he wrote one on this topic. I forgot the title. But
I forgot the title, and now I've forgotten if I read it, because I read a few of his recently, and he does make similar arguments in all of them. I've certainly read some of his arguments. Have you read it?
Yeah, I've read it, and it's really good. I mean, I kind of really summarize it now, but basically, one important point was that psychology, it's used to evade morals, basically. Yeah. And that's certainly how I experience it. I mean, I work now in a forensic hospital, so it's basically a prison, like a mental health prison, you could call it. Like, we have this, I don't know if it's probably the same in Canada, United States, certainly, that if someone commits a really grave crime, say murder or rape, and some expert says, well, this person is mentally deranged. He, at the time when he committed the crime, he cannot held accountable. He cannot be held accountable for it because he was experiencing schizophrenic symptoms at the time, or he has a personality disorder which predisposes him to do such things, and so then he doesn't go to prison, but he goes to this forensic hospital where there are people like me were supposed to make him better, heal him in a way, or treat him, so that at some point you can say, okay, this guy isn't dangerous anymore, we got him under control, let's release him and see what happens. Mm-hmm. And There's very little morality involved, like teaching people how to behave morally. It's more like impulse control, or even working on trying to understand your childhood, but I would say in a very superficial way, like nothing when you mention your experiences, maybe with Jung and integration or such notions have no place there. It's more like, well, you're applying this reductionist behavioral methods.
Mm-hmm. So what is the facility of identifying childhood causes for one's behavior then?
Then I think the reasoning goes, if you understand it, if you understand, for example, how you came to develop a positive attitude towards violence. Once you understand it, like you had a father who acted out violently against you. Once you understand it, you can get some insight into why it might not be good behavior to engage in. Mm-hmm. I don't really get the reasoning, actually. This way of treating criminals, it's very superficial and very ineffective, I would say.
Mm. What about affect? Does that play a part in the process?
It does. Well, they have some these mindfulness skills, you know, like where you're supposed to focus on your bodily emotions and all that.
Mm.
And try to feel anger rising and then maybe identify situations where anger is rising to get out of them, instead of simply waiting until the wave of anger carries you away.
Mm-hmm.
And that's as far as it goes.
Is there anything about releasing trauma from the body by recognizing affective memory?
Not really. No, it's not really what they use. But coming back to this notion of trauma, I mean, that's one thing. I would certainly agree that a lot of people, especially with sexual preference disorders, people, pedophiliacs, or people who have some violent fetishes, many of those people have a history of trauma, and very grave trauma. Like, basically, many people who commit rape have had some experience with rape as well. Like, they've been raped as well.
Mm-hmm.
You have a working model? Like, how do you represent mentally the process whereby the psyche or the soul is injured during trauma? You have a model of any kind, like some natural shielding, which is broken or something. That's sometimes how I try to imagine it.
No, I see it more as something that prevents the psyche from fully landing or becoming integrated with the body, so that. And some of this quite a lot of it draws on Donald Kaufschut's work in A World of Trauma, which is laid out in Prisoner of Infinity, and it is something that never seems to get easier to talk about. But as I sort of understand it, as I kind of try and conceptualize it and visualize it, the psyche, which I'm not sure if is synonymous with the soul or not. I would say not quite exactly, but somewhere in the same ballpark. That it doesn't incarnate in exactly the same way or time that our physical incarnation occurs, that there's a period between conception and maybe 2 years old or something, in which the psyche is becomes fully present and incarnate in the flesh.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas obviously the body arrives sooner than that. And so there's this period of whatever it is, several years anyway, in which we're becoming more and more physically present, you know, from conception to birth to, you know, infanticide, I was about to say, whatever the word is for being an infant, that period, in which psychically we're not fully identified with our body. We don't have a fully formed body image identity. So our psychic awareness or our psychic experience is, I suppose, initially even sort of transcending the mother, but certainly then we become anchored in the mother's body, and then in some sense, like our psyche forms in tandem with or in conformity with the mother in some way. So whatever's happening in the womb, like we're not just in the physical atmosphere or environment of the mother's body, but we're also in the psychic environment of her psyche. And then when we're born, we interact with the mother. You know, she holds us, she smiles at us, gazes at us, and so on. So we begin to develop a sense of ourselves gradually over a period of time, months, a couple of years, through interacting with the mother. So you can imagine that's an incredibly delicate and profound period in which we're actually developing a sense of individual existence. We're becoming fully incarnate. And so if trauma interferes with that, then I'd say what happens is that the body's getting traumatized, whether even if it's not being physically injured, in terms of the negative emotions that are released, that can cause trauma in the body, as in toxins in the body, and that interferes then with the, like, the body becomes less and less of a sort of integrated organ. Like the parts start getting disjointed through these toxins being released, and so it becomes less and less of a safe space or a habitable, is that the word? Comfortable habitat for the psyche. So then the psyche is prevented from actually landing in the body, and as a result, that sort of is represented or it's a ripple down effect where the psyche itself gets fragmented, as in only parts of the psyche can become incarnate, and we can only experience parts of our psyche, while the larger portion of our psyche, and this could even be preconception, I mean, there's metaphysical analysis, whatever theories about this, is that, you know, a psyche or a soul pre-exists conception, and the degree to which the soul can fully incarnate depends on the extent to which that moment of conception creates an opening for it to land in. So it would be ancestral also.
So you imagine this, the soul or the psyche, well, we're not really sure. You were talking about the psyche, right?
I was, and I think that there's, I think that the psyche is something like the soul as it enters into the time stream. I think that the soul is outside of space.
So the soul is higher up in the metaphysical order, basically, you can say.
Yes, I'm reluctant to start getting hierarchical, but if we think of the soul as something that's eternal, then it can't exist within time, whereas the psyche clearly does. It's an incarnation. Maybe it's like Christ, you know, God and man at the same time, soul and psyche.
Well, sometimes you don't get well, but you get good, yeah, at this play hell. Come on, got a feeling, come on, have a feeling, come on, I'm a Robin Cartel, I got a new attitude, I'm making a stand, I'm making a change, today is the day, I've got a grow better face. Thank you. you got good, yeah, at playing dead wood. So come with a feeling, come on, wagon wheeling, come on, fill it baller. I'm becoming just a little bit taller. I'm making a change, I'm changing right now. Gotta face a new day, I'm facing it now.
What I like about, well, let's say scholastic philosophy, like the philosophy of the Middle Ages and by extension Christian philosophy, how they view the body and psyche as truly interrelated. Like, you cannot really separate the soul from the body.
Mm.
And that's something I still to this day have trouble conceptualizing this for me, the relation between, even though I'm a psychologist, didn't do me any good in understanding this, the relation between the soul and the body. And, like, you know, we tend to think of the soul being somehow, or the psyche in the body,
mm-hmm.
like the divine spark, something within you. But then I think these medieval philosophers would say the body is actually in within the soul, contained within the soul.
Yeah.
Expressing the, again, I'm using this word, the metaphysical primacy of spirit over matter. But still, somehow, they're so entirely interrelated, the soul and the body.
Yes. Although I think that, I mean, I guess this is what I was trying to describe that you asked about, that they can be separated.
Not working in tune, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, not. It's like the, you know, theological descriptions of God or understanding of God. I mean, one can be isolated and alienated from God. One can be damned to hell and so on and so forth from a subjective perspective. But but God is infinite and omnipresent. Therefore, wherever one, however estranged one is still within God. By definition.
Then one can close oneself off.
One can close oneself off, yeah. So I think there's something similar, like the body. It's like, I mean, the body, it may, I was visualizing it as the body being centered inside the sphere of the soul. Therefore, when the soul moves, the body moves. But I would say that another way of perhaps visualizing that is if when the body is kind of contracted and traumatized, and it, you know, it's all sort of twisted up and it isn't able to actually work together as a whole organism, then the soul actually can't flow through. You know, it can't distribute itself throughout. The body could still be inside the soul, but the soul can't enter into the body and distribute itself throughout equally.
Hmm. I'd have to think about that now.
Yeah, well, these are not things I've talked about or even thought about much before, so I'm just improvising myself now.
I mean, one thing certainly problematic when thinking about the soul and talking about it, because we tend to form an image, but considering it as pure spirit, we cannot, we shouldn't probably. At least I always do it. I always form some kind of picture. It's very
well.
Difficult.
You have to if you're going to say that the soul and the body are one thing, as you were suggesting that the. That these earlier authorities were positing, which presumably again relates to the incarnation, that God can incarnate in human form and still be God.
Mm-hmm.
But you see, what we know of the body is an image; it's a physical object, albeit a lot, you know, animated, that dies, that is born and that dies.
Mm-hmm.
So. Yeah, we don't have much choice but to. But I think it's not an image so much as a sensation. Like when I was trying to describe it to you, I was trying to experience it, you know, at a sensational level, like the feeling of the body that is enlivened by the soul, that would be a sensational experience, I think. Not an image or, you know.
Okay. I see. So then your concept of trauma, it involves the somehow body and soul not relating properly, or the soul not being able to properly move through the body or incarnate itself in the body.
Yes.
Do you have a theory about schizophrenia, voices, all that? I mean, I should be the one providing the explanation, of course. But as I said, you don't really actually learn. The knowledge is very shallow about these things.
Yeah.
No matter what fancy school you go to these days.
Well, I used to have theories about schizophrenia. I mean, I used to have more theories than I do today. Not such a fan of theories these days. But I would, I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is when you said about voices is, well, there's two things, and I think they're probably related. Like, you know, what is the effect of trauma? Like, what is psychic fragmentation? And how do we experience it? Like at a sensory level, you can see, you know, your body is, there's pain in your body and things, parts don't work and you don't have flexibility. And this is the story of my life. But also one is kind of unaware of what's going on in one's body. One isn't really aware until something bad happens, of how the blood's circulating, how the organs are doing. And that seems somewhat dissociative to me. It seems as though other animals are pretty in tune with what's going on. Like, I remember seeing this show about this guy, this wolf man who lived with wolves, and he said,
like, recently or
he's a contemporary guy. So he dedicated his life to basically becoming like a wolf person. While he was he was a researcher, he was a scientist, so he didn't become feral, but he would spend weeks on end living with wolves, and he learned to imitate them, and he learned and he had to, he decided anyway, for it to work, he had to imitate the wolves, down to things like, you know, at least appearing to eat the raw heart of a, you know, a killed deer and stuff. And anyway, I bring it up because he discovered, you know, how sensitive the wolves were to him and his presence was down to what he'd eaten in the last week. Like, ate just, you know, one Cheeto or something, a week later the wolves would stay away from him, because that transmitted in his whole, you know, the biological apparatus is communicating so much data. So the wolves were that sensitive, never mind to their own organisms, but to his. So imagine, like, that we're so far removed from that level of sensitivity, at a physical level. And then, and then imagine, well, like, the soul is an even more mysterious thing, or a lot more mysterious than the body. You know, what would it entail to be fully incarnate, to be fully cognizant of one's soul life? Well, you know, that's anyone's guess. That's a big reach. But then, so what's it like to be in a fragmented soul? Well, you know, being prey to one's moods, not being able to predict or control one's own behavior, feeling possessed by one's own thoughts, hearing voices, being caught up in patterns that have been passed down by one's parents. Like, all of these things, I would say schizophrenia is just a magnification of what's going on.
Passive fragmentation, basically.
Yeah, and what's going on with all of us. Like, we're just constantly assailed, not just externally, but internally, by these aspects of our being that we can't manage. And if they're really foreign, then we might hear them as voices, or perceive them as invading demons. Not that I'm saying demons don't exist, but it's definitely worth, you know, questioning or exploring that, like, what possession is. Because, of course, yeah.
I sometimes think they do more and more these days. I don't know. Because some of these people, I have a guy who he has a voice telling him to kill himself. And I mean, there's millions, of course. But now I have one I'm working like very closely with. And, well, I used to think it's all, like, what I used to think is that it's, chemical imbalance. That's the key word for everything, basically, now these days. Like, you have chemical imbalance, and then you give some, there's some medication which restores the balance, and then everything is okay. But in practice, it doesn't work like that. Mm-hmm. For many people, the voices don't go away. They get more numb, and they don't really react to these voices anymore. They don't really care anymore. But it's not that. Most medication, well, most cases I know of, the voices didn't really go away for people. And for example, this one guy, he calms down as soon as he gets his painkiller, because he's addicted to painkillers. It's like an addiction. And I don't know, the idea of personal evil, I mean, I'd be a total heretic in my field.
Sure.
Thinking about it, much less proposing it, I'd probably lose my job. But yeah, I don't know. It's the simpler explanation in a way. And then that's why I was asking initially whether you, what's your model of what happens during trauma? Because now the way I come to conceptualize it for myself is that when something happens, like a child, for example, a child gets raped, that there is some layer, protective layer in the psyche which may get ruptured or may not fully develop and provide some, maybe some opening space for malevolent influences.
I think so. Yeah, I mean, that was certainly something that I was aware of when I was talking about that, you know, when the soul can't become fully aligned with the body, then that does seem that that leaves a space for something else to enter in. And I do suspect that this is the primary agenda of the organized, you know, mass traumatization that seems to be going on the planet now. But does that mean that it's demonic? I mean, as in demonic entities? Well, the theological model is that demons pre-exist human beings, I think, or certainly the angels did, because Lucifer was, that was how he fell, was by refusing to bow down to humanity. So I know that theologically, well, that's the model, and I don't, you know, I just don't know, it may well be accurate, but I certainly think that there are apparently malevolent entities, or, you know, phenomena that are apparently entities and that are definitely apparently malevolent, that I would say have to do with human fragments and that are ancestral, and that I've talked about this on a previous podcast, but it's just something that I have an intuitive sense of, so I'm not really.
You were also writing about it in this piece on, there was something about the ancestral factors in your piece on transgenderism, right?
I think so, or in the comments possibly. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I feel a resistance to talking about it, but at the same time, I think it's probably a good thing to talk about it, because it's like, it's not either or. Like, psychology, I see psychology as a necessary deepening of our religious knowledge base, let's say. That I don't think it's possible to go back to the old theological doctrines and just say, let's clear out everything that's that we've discovered since then and just return to Christian doctrine. I mean, to some extent, I mean, as far as if you're just going to surrender to faith, then fine. But in terms of if we're trying to actually find new ways to articulate our experience, I don't think it's possible. And so this is like a perhaps a microcosmic example of this is that there isn't much in that I know of in theological doctrine about ancestral influences, and there certainly isn't anything about psychological fragmentation, multiple person, you know, dissociative identity disorder. And I think that these things, I think there's a potential for a much deeper, more nuanced understanding of what's happening, and that one major aspect of that is that there's a spectrum between ancestral patterns that we get possessed by, that even your field will acknowledge because it's in the neurology, and theological accounts of demonic possession at the other end of the spectrum, and, you know, Satan and all his agents. And then somewhere in the middle is this metaphysical doctrine which pertains to ancestral influence, which is not just genetic but energetic, and that there are actual ancestral presences that are discarnate that are influencing us. And that these presences, whatever they are and however they came to be, and I'd say that this is also a sort of, you know, pathology that transcends death, because I think pathology can transcend death, that those ancestral distortions or residue, or whatever they are, like shells in the Kabbalistic thing, attempt to possess the descendants and live through them.
So would that be like a, I don't know, poisoning of the psychic atmosphere? For example, well, whether in a house or in a country, maybe, I don't know, like, for example, Germany now paying for Nazism with, I don't know, whatever malevolent influences we have around here still.
Sure, but you could also see Nazism as a symptom of ancestral possession, like an unresolved trauma that just keeps possessing subsequent generations to behave in more and more traumatized ways because of the parenting. Like I say, you can look at it psychologically and sociologically and you won't be wrong. It's just that that's the, you know, the root, that's the surface, and there's these really deep, much deeper roots that go all the way into the metaphysical realm. So then at the end of the day, it does seem as though psychology isn't enough, never mind clinical psychology, never mind, you know, pharmaceuticals, never mind transhumanism. It's like we're getting further and further, getting more and more into a mechanistic interpretation, which then provides the mechanical solution, which of course makes the problem worse. We're just dissociating further and further away. And so it does seem as though, yes, it's right and necessary to trace back rather than to try and keep elaborating forward. Like, we've already crossed the line of we've crossed some line anyway. So the theological and the Orthodox Christian viewpoint, it seems to provide a necessary ground. Like, I think, you know, what we've got currently, at least me personally, but I think it's pretty widespread, is we have a Gnostic metaphysic.
Yeah, I would certainly agree. I would agree. Even speaking again from the field I'm working in, this psychology, clinical psychology, it's the fundamental axiom is you can help yourself, we can help yourself, or we can help you, making out of yourself a better man, a better person, without reference to any higher principles. Without any surrender, except maybe to the therapist, but to the state, I guess.
To the technology.
To the technology, yeah, certainly to the technology, but that in itself, this employment of technology, I mean, that's a weird neo-Gnostic way, I think, of thinking, right? It ties in with transhumanism and all that as well.
Yes. Yeah, well, I mean, Gnosticism, it certainly has its allure.
It has.
And it did seem to me, for me, it seemed like a necessary counterpoint to the Orthodox Christian viewpoint, which, like, I mean, if you look at Jehovah, like even Jung went here, especially Jung, who was Gnostic, in the Old Testament, it's really objectionable. Like, worship that? That's Al Pacino and Devil's Advocate, isn't it? Never! It's like there's something about the way that ancient man formulated the divine, which, well, it's politically incorrect and spiritually incorrect even. You know, it's like a tyrant, a petty tyrant, really, full of, you know, given to tantrums and vicious behavior and all the rest of it. But I think that there's, and this is in the book of Job, there's actually, there's sort of a deeper truth in that, which is that, well, any divinity that we perceive or interpret, at least, but even perceive, it's going to be filtered through our own psychological patterns. And so it's going to represent that in some ways. This is actually what I write about Whitley Strieber and his visitors, that they become sort of embodiments of his own neuroses in some way. And I think one can look at Jehovah in that way, that the early man was much more kind of openly neurotic, much more primitive. And so the way that he or we represented the deity was also kind of, it mirrored that. But that the essence, that this is God, so you can't judge God. You just have to submit to the certainty or the faith that God is good. Like, into the modern mindset, that's slavish, but that's kind of the point. The very thing that makes it hard, I mean, almost impossible, is what makes it valuable. That trusting, absolute trusting in the benevolence of what is greater than us. It would be easy if it was just manifestly benign. Well, there wouldn't be any, you know, surrendering in that. You'd just say, great, I'm going to worship God because God is good and he's going to make my life better. Well, so there's something built into our, you know, our very nature, that we, fear of God is the beginning of wisdom. We have to get past the fearsome face of God, surrender to that before we can be embraced by the good. And Gnosticism just said no to that. Said no, I see God as evil, and therefore God is just a demiurge, and the whole of nature is evil, and even the human body is evil. It's like it took it to its inevitable conclusion, which was a rejection not just of the demiurge but of ourselves.
I would say it provides good counterpoints, but maybe more when looking at the Old Testament in isolation.
Yeah.
Because I mean, yeah, the Yahweh of the Old Testament certainly was terrible. Then again, I think I'm not really well versed in theology, but I guess whenever there was an outbreak of Yahweh's anger in the Old Testament, mankind somehow deserved it, earned it.
Yeah, blamed themselves, absolutely, yeah. Yeah.
And then again, also, Christ wasn't incarnated yet, so needs to be taken into account as well, I guess.
Yeah.
But I can certainly I know the allure of Gnosticism. I mean, I think now looking back, I've encountered it under so many guises, without really knowing what it was at the time. But when I think back of now, many of the books I've read, and there is a kind of a feeling that goes with it, that it's a very promising feeling of relief. But also for me, when I think back, whenever there was Gnosticism involved, this the legitimizing of giving into all kinds of impulses and urges, mm-hmm. and engaging in extreme forms of behavior, possibly damaging behavior. That's, I know the feeling.
Right. Well, I guess that's true in my case too. I certainly did, and I believed it. I mean, it was, in retrospect, it was the left-hand path of, as I said to Charles Upton, like, learning through error, trial and error. But I didn't see it that way at the time. I didn't think I'm going to do everything wrong now so I can see the wrongness of it. I thought something like, I suppose it was a bit like testing God, like if God is truly good, he won't condemn me for any of this. So this is, this in a sense is my trusting in God. Like this is a deeper trust than if I was devout and obedient. I'm trusting that God will, but also the belief that God wants independent agents to act sort of spontaneously and impulsively. That was a big part of it. Like I felt like I was not under the law. But I was the law even. And well, I think that's true if you're Christ, but I also kind of thought I was Christ. I mean, we all are. At least I believed that then, and I still believe that now. So,
in what sense do you believe we are Christ?
Well, in the sense that Christ is all of us, so therefore we must be him. Like, Christ is... Christ is the Son of Man, so Christ is like the whole of humanity. I mean, it's the marriage, I suppose. We're supposed to be the bride of Christ, but certainly I don't see why the bride wouldn't be equal to the groom. Although, of course, it's not the same. But I guess that's the point I was getting to, was that it's one thing theoretically to say that, in union I am Christ, but that doesn't mean that I have actually surrendered to, you know, to be to the consummation, let's say, with Christ, because I hadn't and I haven't. Like it's no easy matter, it's no simple thing. But I certainly had many I guess subterfuges really, but also dreams and visions by which I felt that I'd been chosen and so on and so forth. I don't even necessarily want to get into all that, although I think it's probably quite common actually that we can become identified with Christ, and I think probably the Gnostic mythology was useful in that regard as well, in terms of formulating a Christ that I could be identified with that would continue to enable my impulses, let's say.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I would certainly would draw the boundary somewhere and saying that, okay, well, I can maybe participate in Christ in a way, but never be equal to him.
Why not?
Because, I mean, that would probably constitute an act of pride, because then I would be God, right? It would be.
Yes, I know, but it's like, like I said, if Christ is God and God is everything, then how can we not be that? Ouch.
Which would be pantheism in a way, right?
Well, no. I mean, I guess this is where the problem arises. I've got this pain in my shoulder, frozen shoulder. Is that, well, I mean, the ego can get hold of any truth and flip it over without knowing, you know, without admitting that it's done so. So yes, of course one can approach this with pride and not admit to oneself that it's pride, and one is in fact identifying with Lucifer. Well, I did identify with Lucifer consciously.
I heard.
And my reasoning for that was that something like, well, Lucifer's the shadow of God, so I should start with the shadow. And also it was a way to be more humble about it, and also I guess it was a recognition that I was in a place of pride. I was, you know, I was prideful, and therefore I would be honest enough to know that I wasn't identified with Christ. But I certainly saw it as it's like I wanted to bring about a reconciliation, I suppose, in myself, between the Christ and the Lucifer aspects of my own being. Certainly, the Christ aspect of our being transcends us, so yeah, we can't be identified with it in that sense, but I still think there's something about giving Christ dominion over one's life that makes one become subject to Christ and therefore be Christ, mm-hmm. essentially.
Okay.
Well, if you want to shake a spare, point it at the volunteer. Everybody got paid, our receipts are on display. But the volunteer weeps much better than he sweeps. He's a regular, a fellow like a rhino, he will bellow.
Then I would agree. Then you're the subject, I mean, giving him dominion, that's like, yeah, giving in to God, I guess.
Yeah, it's just that it can't be a, I'll give in to God if I can get to be God's instrument sort of thing, because
yes.
That's the Gnostic thing again. It's like I said, for me, it's not the lofty philosophical or theological stuff. It's the grind. It's the daily grind of just saying, well, life really is so unbelievably hard, and I'm just getting older, and I'm going to die, and somehow this is all good,
mm-hmm.
and it's not for me to understand the how and the why of the good. All I can do is struggle to express what is best within me, and let it express through me, and experience it that way. You know, as a vehicle for that. And so I suppose in that sense I probably still have the same point of view, which is that I used to say, if you want to see the miracle, you have to be the miracle. And so if we want to see God, we have to let God be us. We just have to let God live through us, and then we don't get to see us as God. We just, I don't know what it is really. I think it's just being allowing the presence of what is good to be, you know, to be more present, and then it does, of course, it affects our lives.
Right, to let it work through us, maybe. I mean, then that way you'd still preserve a difference on the level of being, as in you'd never really be God. I mean, I certainly don't think that I'd ever be omniscient and all powerful and everything.
No, right.
But I could make the all good and the omniscient work through me. Maybe act more morally and maybe somewhat more knowledgeable about things. Certainly not omniscient, but so that on the level of being, there would be still this somewhere there, at least in my the way I conceptualize it, there would be there would be an unbridgeable gap between somehow. I mean, in the Orthodox, at least in Catholicism, I don't know about Orthodox, Eastern Orthodox, but they say that the graces that God does give you, it's totally, it's like a present.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's unearned.
It's not really like something you can. It's not a deal. Like you have a right to it, but
No,
it's
no. You,
gifts freely.
yeah, absolutely. So that's back to what I was trying to describe in my own life, which is a humbling. It's just like becoming more and more humble in the face of death, for one thing, you know, pain, suffering, other people's suffering, and you know, all that transcends that. I can't say in the face of God, because I'm not obviously looking in the face of God, but certainly becoming more realistic anyway about my limitations and an awareness of the infinite and the eternal. I mean, it can't not have that effect, and vice versa. Like, the more we sort of surrender to our limitations, I mean, the more that we see ourselves as we are, the more we can see what is greater than us, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, it's not an easy thing to talk about at all, but
no.
I've sort of got the back of my mind, I got Jordan Peterson, because it was in the email, and as a contrast, perhaps, like, like you were saying, that this understanding that grace comes to us through God's will, not because of anything we've done to achieve it. Well, that sort of, I think that one has to have a certain level of maturity to really be able to benefit from that.
Mm-hmm.
Because if, I mean, you could see how that would go the other way, that if one believed that there was a God that existed that could bestow us with his grace, but there was nothing we could do to increase our chances of getting that grace, you could see how that could lead.
That's not what the doctrine says, right? I mean, it says, like, okay, when you become more, I don't know how to say, like, by doing good works,
mm.
by behaving morally, and I don't know what, feeding the poor, clothing the naked.
Yeah.
You do, in a way, maybe you do merit, or you become I'm lacking the words here. As a container which can receive the grace of God,
mm-hmm.
you become more, more appropriate container.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very, not well said, but you know what I mean, right? It's like,
yeah, more congruent, perhaps, with
congruent. Yeah, more congruent, and but still, even if you do, in a way, you still, there's still that you don't have you cannot go to God, knock at his door, and say, "Hey, I did my good works. Now, where's the grace?"
You can't expect them, even, because you can't be doing the good deeds in order to get God's favor. So yeah, I overstated it, but you could, I overstated it with a reason, which is that, because, and this is why I brought up Jordan Peterson, because we're enculturated now, like, our egos are configured so, I would say, so precisely or so tightly towards reward and punishment, for one thing, but in terms of acting for gain, in terms of bringing about results, like, we're supposed to live our lives, gather knowledge, develop our personalities, streamline our identities, all of this, it's all about results, it's all about cause and effect, essentially, because we're in charge of our lives. So even if we are religious, it seems almost inevitable that we're going to impose that psychic configuration onto our attitude to God and good deeds and all the rest of it. Like the spiritual progress is another one. Like if you, any spiritual seeker on the spiritual path, so called, is they're basically trying to rack up points.
Yeah.
And yet they know that the biggest point of all, or the biggest score of all, is if you can let go of the need to rack up points and just live a virtuous life, right? So that we're caught in this, you know, this vicious circle, which I don't know if there's a solution to it or not. And so what I wonder about with Peterson, like, because he seems to be feeding that part, the results-driven ego, even or perhaps especially when it comes to, or he's incorporating his religious iconography and symbolism and narratives into, I would say, that basic model of live a better life, be a better person, and you'll steer the world away from hell and towards heaven. And you know, people, you'll have a better life, you'll be successful in the world and so on. So so what I wonder is how consciously he's doing that, because he knows it's inevitable anyway, and that because you know, for me, it wouldn't have helped if someone had told me when I was 20, well, forget about your own desires and forget about trying to achieve anything and forget about trying to become enlightened or super uber shaman, because actually at the end of it all, you'll just realize that it was a waste of time and you're powerless anyway, and you know, just become a Christian, you might as well, and work in a thrift store. Obviously it wouldn't make any difference, because I had to actually burn off all of that, not all of it, but a great deal of that ego. You know, that those mechanisms, in order to really see how encumbering they were. So yeah, I wonder with Peterson, like, is he consciously addressing that, feeding that part in people in order that they can see it better, or is he himself possessed by it?
I don't know. I mean, it's in a way, it's presumptuous for me to say, but I, like I said in my email, I think I can, since I study psychology and doing, and he's really, I mean, I recently watched it, and there was, sometimes he answers these listeners questions, like very short ones. And I looked into some of them to see and where he stands on some issues. And, there was one person asking, the question was, where can I find it, or how do I find a good therapist? And then he was going on about how, you have to get someone with a PhD. I'm not saying a PsyD is bad. No, I don't even know. It's probably one degree less or something. We have a different system, but he was basically saying you should get someone with the highest degree, which is not at all reflective of your being empathetic, being a good listener, a good talker, but just, did you get into a good school? Did you study like hell to get your PhD there? And then he was basing this on, they know the news, the most recent scientific achievements, and they've read all the studies and all these things, like this, this, and that, my point is, I think he's very much, his mindset is very much that of establishment, academia, and he's in the flux of this achievement-driven, you know, toiling away, and a very non-spiritual, in fact, I would say, very achieved. And all these, and you said this in your previous podcast, or some of your guests said it, that All those advices he's giving is aimed at making people's lives better on a material basis, mostly, right? Or in terms of recognition by others, achieving in some sort way. And, well, like I said, I think this is, there's not much wisdom I can detect there. For me, it's presumptuous to say, because I don't have much wisdom, but I don't see much in what he's doing.
Yeah. Well, I was just trying, you know, slightly being devil's advocate, but also give the benefit of the doubt, which I generally find hard to do with people. I mean, I tend to just look for the worst, and then if I don't find it, look harder. But
that's part of being humble. It's probably a good thing to do that. Continue with it.
To give the benefit of the doubt. Well, certainly being balanced. I mean, knowing I have this other tendency in myself, and also that, I mean, perhaps it's a deeper question, because I think that, you know, a person's intentions don't count for much anyway, as we know, the road to hell and all that. So a person can even have bad intentions and there could be good consequences. I mean, it's got to go the other way too. So to the extent that, I mean, Peterson is embodying something in the collective now. I mean, that's undeniable, I think, in terms of his popularity. He represents something to people. And that can be useful in and of itself, although, of course, only if people really recognize the true nature of it. But I would agree with your estimation that, and I remember him on one of his maps of meaning thing, he even said that for him, psychology is about human engineering.
Yeah, yeah, that's one video I saw, yeah. A psychologist is an engineer of the soul.
Yeah.
Smells of Gnosticism as well, right?
It certainly does. And I think, well, I mean, never mind the hubris of such a statement and the rather sinister kind of MK Ultra style overtones, but that I think that that's inseparable from this notion that what's good for the ego, the social identity in terms of being prosperous, successful, happy, is good for the soul. That there's an assumption implicit in Peterson's approach, which, I mean, again, benefit the doubt. Well, if the soul and the body are one, I mean, there certainly is merit in that. Like, the more comfortable and at ease and relaxed we are physically, the more we can tune into that signal within us. No doubt that's true, but that's not about success. That's about creating an environment or discovering an environment that is congruent with one's nature, so that one can really feel at home within it. And I doubt that Jordan Peterson's very at home being this massive global phenomenon. I don't know how anyone could be.
I'm not sure. I think I believe, especially now in the age of internet. I mean, for a while I did have him as a Facebook feed, and he's constantly just defending himself against some whatever stupid feminist attack, or then he posts some study which proves supposedly that, you know, this is the biological root of difference between male and female. Something you also talked about in your article, some prenatal testosterone, whatever. And now he seems stressed out in a way. Although, I don't know. He looks healthy.
He does look healthy.
For his age.
Yes, well, that's, I mean, because there's all kinds of variables there. So if he's archetypally possessed and or just really riding a high now, you would expect him to look good. And he may well be feeling good, but that's not the same as... I mean, this is the crux, really, is that what's good for the ego is not generally good for the soul. It might be good for the body for a while, because the ego gets what it wants. It will treat its body good. It will feed it well and so on. It might not, but it might. And certainly, obviously, wealth increases one's health generally, unless one goes crazy with it. But the soul, it does seem to require... I suppose it just requires... real contact with reality, I think, more than anything, just as the body does. Like, the body thrives. The body doesn't thrive like on the internet, you know, ferociously tweeting arguments back and forth, or, you know, releasing 10 YouTube videos a day or whatever it is, like all those things are to do with participating in the collective experience, and I'm not denigrating them, they have value. Obviously I put a lot of energy into that myself, but I'd say that the body thrives most of all like being in nature, and even and I don't do this, so I'm being a bit hypocritical, but even like living a little wild in nature, and living a bit rough and so on, and I'd say the same is true for the soul. Like it requires and there certainly is a in between area, like in terms of facing challenges. Like Peterson, certainly he's bitten off an awful lot for a single soul to chew. This point about giving people the tools to become more socially functioning, more socially skilled, more socially adept, more heroic even. My feeling is that that's not sure how to finish the thought exactly, but I think that it's, and we're talking about who are you to speak and who am I to speak. Now I'm going to psychoanalyze Peterson, but I suspect that it's a kind of subterfuge to validate his own choices, because that's the path he's taken. Like the path to worldly success, and
So you mean like drawing other people with him and thereby confirming his or justifying his own path, or the way he has taken in life?
Consolidating and justifying it, yeah.
I've been thinking on this, like in terms of, like, although I also wrote to you in my email that I'm becoming more and more interested in questions of morality simply because I've never heard about them in my studies. And like all these, for example, now there was this abortion referendum in Ireland, and you know, whenever these things occur, that you always have these protesters pro legalization of whatever aberration, and everybody's going crazy, and even people who have nothing to do with the issue supporting those things. I think it's maybe the same, like similar to what we were talking about with Peterson, that people just want to confirm their own immorality, maybe. I mean, there's the judge speaking, of course, but assuming we have some objective moral givens in reality, you have to judge at some point. It might well be that Peterson, he's made a lot of money now, selling all his books and giving all his talks and telling people basically how to do the same. Or, right? I mean, it's very simplistic.
It's implicit, but if you're going to, if you're going to inspire people and teach them and direct them, then you're going to do it most profoundly by modeling your behavior. And that's certainly what he himself has claimed, that all these young men have been saying to him from the early days, not just that they transformed their lives or saved them, but specifically that they saw the way he was and they said, I want to be like that. I want to talk like Jordan Peterson talks. You know, I want to be upright like Jordan Peterson. He's a model, like a classic guru or Führer figure. And so there's no place that a line is suddenly going to appear to the people that are being inspired to model his behavior or to imitate his behavior, between him just as a teacher at University of Toronto, who's just really passionate and inspiring to people, and him as this you know, worldwide celebrity figure who's making millions of dollars. That's now become the thing that that people will be emulating. So I mean, that does raise questions, like, in terms of, I've even helped to parry arguments, it's just on Reddit, so it's not like it was a frequent thing, but from Peterson followers, that essentially, who was I to criticize him, because he had written a bestseller that millions of people loved, therefore he was great. Yeah. Therefore, he's walking his talk, everything he says must be true because he's embodying it and he's got a bestseller. So it's almost as though he's modeling a philosophy that basically measures, and this is so American, it measures your value as a human being according to your worldly success.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there's kind of nothing more destructive than that, I'd say.
Yeah. Yeah, so I mean, I wouldn't even go so far in saying that if we're talking objective moral standards and theology, he might well be doing himself and his followers harm, right? From actually leading them away. I mean, he's producing this counterfeit spirituality. It's not even spirituality, it's just counterfeit, I don't know.
Well, it's pragmatic, isn't it? Isn't it spiritual pragmatism or something like that?
Yeah. Yeah. Like a way of life, but I mean, if we're talking about ultimate significance for the soul, since he's a psychologist, I would say its ultimate object is God, the divine, ultimate reality, whatever we call it. He's, even if we're not talking about a personal God, I mean, he's certainly not encouraging people to meditate on these notions. At least not for what I said. I mean, it's providing the context for his narratives.
Mm-hmm.
The Judeo-Christian, worldview, but I felt nothing in him that, brings me to suspect he would try to lead people to familiarize themselves with the divine. And there's nothing in there.
That's the end of the first part of my conversation with Simon Strzok. Part two will be up next week at horticulture.com/liminalist. This is Jason Horsley at the podcast Between. Thanks for listening. Thanks for your support and donations. I'll try to keep the podcast going. Not sure right now, as ever. Things seem liminal. Doing a meeting on Sunday, that'll be the day after this podcast goes up, probably Sunday the 24th, might have even been passed by the time you hear this, but something that I hope to be doing more of, which is the participatory meetups with interested parties. Maybe, baby. Also, I'm going to be in England, London mostly, in late July and August, second week of August, I guess. So if anyone is interested in organising some sort of live AFK meetup, let me know. This is the podcast Between.